y'all. Thanks for listening to Killer Queens.
Or KQ if you're nasty.
Welcome to the show where two 90s loving country chicks gab about true crime and tell each other to talk to the hand because the face ain't listening. I'm Torella.
And I'm Tori.
And we're sisters who have always loved true crime and decided to turn that obsession into a show with a light take on the topic.
Kind of like diet true crime, it's all the flavor and fewer calories.
Now with our show, you'll get true crime, 90s nostalgia, and a few four-letter words sprinkled in.
Because I always say that Polly Pockets and true crime go together like peas and carrots.
Be sure to check out our case submission form on our website at killerqueenspodcast.com and follow us on social media and YouTube.
Now grab your Surge, your 3D Cool Ranch Doritos, and your kitten surprise, and let's get into the episode.
This podcast contains discussion of child murder, brutality, and lying to yourself forever. Listener discretion is advised.
On Saturday, March 1st, 2008, the Caffey family home in Emory, Texas was engulfed in flames. Terry Caffey, the father, had been shot 5 times and had amazingly escaped the burning home and crawled 500 yards to his neighbor's house where 911 was called. Firefighters found the burned remains of 38-year-old Penny Caffey, 13-year-old Matthew, and 8-year-old Tyler. Still missing was 16-year-old Aaron. Terry was immediately rushed to the hospital and into surgery. Once Terry was in recovery, a Raines County sheriff told him that his only daughter was alive and well. Unfortunately, Terry's relief that Aaron was safe was short-lived. The sheriff also told Terry that she was in custody for being involved in the murders. He was stunned. There was no way that his daughter had anything to do with this. However, Terry and the rest of the community were shocked to find that the evidence against Aaron was overwhelming.
Hey, you guys, welcome to Killer Queens. If you've never been here before, we want to give you just a little information about how the show is set up and what it's meant to accomplish. If you have been here before, welcome back. You can just use that handy skip ahead feature here if you want to.
We want to give a message to friends and family of the victims. We know that there may be someone involved in the case who might listen one day, and we want you to know that our intention is to only bring awareness to this case. And while we do use personal stories in some instances and our own humor in order to tell the story in a way that listeners can relate, we have the utmost respect for victims and their families.
We created Killer Queens to be a place where we can have open discussions about cases just like you would with friends. We are not investigators. We use information that is available to the public, such as documentaries, case files, and media coverage. Using this information, we intend to tell the story of what happened in each case that we cover. Now, will you agree with our interpretations or conclusions of each case? Well, heck no.
Mm-mm. We each approach cases from different perspectives, life experiences, and beliefs that we already have in place. And sometimes these differences are slight, yet they can be wide enough to cause divide and upset some of those listening. We do our best to present the facts as we find them in our research, but we do bring our own perspectives to the case. We understand that you will too. We want you to know that this is a safe space to discuss differences and opinions in a civilized manner. Our style may not be your personal preference, and if that's the case, we know you'll be able to find one of the many other shows out there to tell the story the way you want to hear it. We can be grown-ups about it if you can.
Now, if we are your cup of tea and you want even more KQ, you can join our Patreon and get access to our entire catalog of episodes ad-free and access to bonus episodes too. And I'll give you just a little hint if you're an ad skipper, but you still want the deals that we have from our sponsors each week, you can scroll down to the show notes and see what coupons we have available for you right down there.
But you didn't hear it from us.
That's a pro tip, but I'll deny ever sharing it.
Right. So all that being said, let's get into the story.
Oh my. Oh my. Before we get going today, of course, we want to give a hey girl thanks to Takara Miles. Hopefully one of those was correct. Beautiful either way. Jill Nicole Moore, Daisy Buchanan, and Brandy Scott. Thank you for requesting this case.
I didn't realize we had a literary icon in the building, Daisy Buchanan.
Did I learn that in school? Possibly.
I think you should have. Isn't she from The Great Gatsby?
Oh, yeah. Oh my gosh. That's amazing.
Yeah, love it.
Love your style, girl.
Yeah, thanks so much. And also thank you to Madison for writing this up for us.
Yes, thank you. All right, so we are going to jump into the case. We're going to talk about who were the Caffeys. So the Caffeys were a family of five who started their lives in Alba, Texas. Penny and Terry Caffey met when she was 21 and he was 24 at a revival meeting in Garland, Texas. And their faith is what brought them together and led them to start a family together. The couple was incredibly excited when Penny gave birth to a baby girl, Erin Michelle Caffey, in July of 1991. 3 years later, Erin became an older sister to Matthew Ryan Caffey, who was affectionately known as Bubba. And then 5 years after Matthew came their third and final child, which was a son named Tyler Paul Caffey. And they felt like that was their complete family. The Caffeys were a conservative and faith-centered family. Both Penny and Terry worked as ministers at Miracle Faith, which was a Baptist church. And Penny also played piano for the church. Tyler and Matthew played the guitar and the harmonica. And Erin had what everybody described as a beautiful singing voice. She was so talented that the church's pastor once said that if he had a few more of her, he would have no problem filling the church on Sundays. This feels just, it's a small town, you know, so maybe just not a lot of singing voices around.
Maybe not. I have a hard time personally wanting to give her any
credit.
Yeah. I mean, I won't lie. Like, I did watch the Killer Women with Pierce Morgan, who I have my own issue with Pierce. I sometimes refer to him as Piss Aunt Pierce. Don't like him. Never have.
Okay.
Never will. Yeah. Just don't enjoy him.
Mm-hmm.
However, they opened this with him asking Erin to sing, I think it was Amazing Grace. And I feel uncomfortable when anybody, which is ironic because all I do is sing. Like, all I want to do is just sing songs all the time. But I felt uncomfortable because she sang more of it than I was prepared for. And I'm like, oh, okay, I kind of want to skip through this. I don't know about a cappella Amazing Grace. And she doesn't have a terrible voice, don't get me wrong.
No,
but
yeah.
But she's no Sister Act 2 singing My Jesus Washed. Oh, okay, sure.
Yeah.
So, all right.
So, yeah. And also, she did a lot of bad stuff, so it's kind of hard to, you know, not saying that you can never come out of that. It just, I don't know.
You are not your worst mistake. However, her worst mistake's pretty fucking bad. So,
pretty bad.
I'm just having a little bit of a hard time like reconciling that in my soul. But
yeah,
you know.
Yeah. Terry and Penny were very protective of their children, especially of their only daughter. Erin was often described as sweet, but she was also described as very naive and sheltered, which makes sense. I mean, she had been homeschooled, you know, for a while, but this was also a very small town. And, you know, when you're little, you only know, like, what your parents give you access to, essentially. Now, this was before the internet, really. Like, yeah. The internet was around, but it was not a household thing in the 90s, of course. Like, not everybody had it. So, like, kids now know a lot more than we might necessarily want them to.
Well, and, I mean, you're able to stream lots of things at, like, a moment's, like, you can get anything, anytime, anywhere. Whereas in this day and age, like, when we were growing up, it was like what your parents allowed you to see, but also what you were exposed to in your community. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And if you were gonna like download an unedited version of a song, it was gonna take you 19 hours to get one song done. And by then, you're just like, and then if somebody tried to pick up the phone during that time, forget it. Start over. Like,
that's what spring break and fall break are for.
Yeah.
Completing your mix CD.
Yeah. I've got like 4 more songs I need to do, and that will take me the entirety of the week. So, yeah, she was pretty, you know, she knew what she knew, whatever. So, Erin started 8th grade at Raines Junior High while her 2 younger brothers attended Raines Elementary School. But that same year,
Terry and Penny pulled all three of their children out of public school following an incident with Erin at her middle school. Another female student was rumored to have a crush on Erin and had supposedly kissed her in the hallway at school. Her parents considered this to be incredibly inappropriate, and Terry said that his family was, quote, shocked by the culture of bisexuality. So they decided to homeschool all three children. Penny began teaching them a Bible-based curriculum at home.
So this is now making her even less, even more naive and sheltered, because now she's not exposed to anything outside of the home or Bible-based culture.
Which is just not the world that she's going to encounter as an adult and even as a young adult. Like, you know, and again, that's their decision. It's their kids. So that's what they want to do. For 13-year-old Erin, who had been diagnosed with ADHD and had difficulty keeping up with her classmates, her parents thought, okay, well, she'll get more individual attention this way. They thought it would benefit her educationally as well. But in the social aspect, Erin had been a very social child, and then she was then isolated to like just home and church. So, I mean, that was tough for her. When she turned 16 in July of 2007, she got her driver's license and an old Chevy pickup truck, and she was super excited to finally have some freedom. She started applying for jobs, and she ended up being hired to work part-time at a local Sonic as a car hop. And this was one, I don't know who all has Sonics or whatever, but like back in the day when Sonic started, all the car hops wore roller skates. That's all they wore. And you know, you have the stalls and whatever. And then after a while, that kind of went away. But there are some that still do the skates, which I remember being young and being like, that's where I want to work. I want to roller skate all day.
I mean, it was really cool. I could have probably done it back then on roller blades, because roller skating has never been my ministry personally. I suck at it. There is a big difference for me personally. But I would have been like Monica at, what was it called? Like the Moonshine Cafe or Moon Dance Cafe that she worked at, where it was like,
oh, yeah.
They put everybody on roller skates.
Into everybody. Yeah. Or into everything. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Erin seemed to do well with it. She was a roller skate car hop, and she did great. And I mean, I'm assuming this is true for here, but like for us after school, once I could drive, like we would go to the Sonic, we'd get a milkshake or whatever. Like kids hung out there a lot. Kids would just hang out at Sonic at night.
Yes. And I don't know if this is something that happens everywhere, but Sonic does have a happy hour. So we'd go and it was like half off drinks or something, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So
or you get like cheaper burgers on a certain night. Yeah, they have like something every night. So plenty of people are coming here just to hang out. Kids her age are coming there to hang out, and she's got boys flirting with her. And it's like a whole new experience for her because she's not been around other people for so long. And her coworkers remembered her blushing as she told them about guys asking her for her phone number. So now she's being exposed to more people and, you know, different things or whatever. But people still described her as shy and sheltered, and kind of like her being in Sonic was like her being introduced to the real world for the first time. So that summer, while she was working at Sonic, Erin met 18-year-old Charlie Wilkinson when she went to take his order. And he recalled that the moment that she'd skated up to the window of his 1991 Ford Explorer, he felt an instant connection. He had just returned home from boot camp from the Texas National Guard and was planning to go on active duty after his senior year in high school. He had no run-ins with law enforcement, no significant disciplinary issues at school. He spent most of his free time hunting and fishing. Charlie's parents were divorced. He lived with his father, stepmother, and Steph and Hap's siblings.
The Steph and Hap siblings.
That's not even so, a word.
So close, but
yeah, so far.
So
yeah.
Far.
Yeah, that was a whoopsie there. I'm assuming you guys know that what I meant was Step and Hap siblings.
Yes. Got it. Okay.
So he had never gotten in like really serious trouble, but people did describe him as being kind of hot-tempered and easily provoked.
After first meeting Aaron, Charlie returned time after time to Sonic to visit her. Shortly after Halloween, Charlie worked up the courage to ask Aaron out, and she told her parents that she'd met someone that she really liked. They, of course, wanted to meet him before things went any further. So Terry recalled that his first meeting with Charlie did not go as he expected. When Charlie came over to their house, Terry greeted him by extending his hand and saying, "You must be Charlie." And Charlie goes, "Yeah, and you are?" It's like, you can assume I'm Mr. Caffey. That's what you can assume. Like,
yeah.
Where's your Mr. and Mrs.?
Well, and for him to be in some branch of some sort of military, you would think that maybe he would have a little bit of respect and learn that you just can't talk to elders and, you know what I mean? Like,
I know it's not that way everywhere, but definitely in the South, like this is in Texas. You don't meet your potential girlfriend's father and not immediately, "Yes, sir, nice to meet you." Or, you know, like you're going to do a sir, you're going to call him Mr., you're not going to call him Terry. That's no. Like it's yes, ma'am, no, ma'am, yes, sir, no, sir, here. Like that's how you're raised.
Well, I'll tell you this. So I am 35 years old and I have a neighbor that we've had since we were born. And when I referenced his wife as her first name, he came back at me. It wasn't rude necessarily, but he was like, "Miss blah, 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 Miss blah, blah, blah." And I was like, I got it. Okay. Even if I'm 75 years old, we're going to call her Miss so-and-so because, okay, like that, I get it.
Yeah. I don't know how to do that. I'll have people sometimes tell me, like, because I'll call them, you know, Miss whatever. And they're like, "You can just call me my first name. You make me feel old." And I'm like, I'm not trying to make you feel old. It's just, I don't know how to not do that. Like that has been like beat into me pretty much. But so the intro didn't go like, it wasn't like picture perfect, but Aaron was allowed to see Charlie as long as they followed her parents' rules. So she was not allowed to go out with Charlie alone. However, of course, this did not stop them from seeing each other. So Charlie would spend a lot of time with Aaron at her house until he was forced to leave at Aaron's 9 p.m. curfew. And then after that, they would talk on the phone until her phone curfew at 10 o'clock on weekdays and 11 o'clock on weekends. And then Charlie even started going to church with Aaron at Miracle Faith. And to everybody around who like saw them, it seemed like just this innocent puppy love. In December of 2007, Aaron asked her mom and dad if she could enroll in public school again. And her younger brothers had gone back to public school earlier that fall, and she'd been working and doing really well with that. And they were really impressed with how she was like handling everything, and they let her go back. So she's now a freshman at high school. Charlie also attended the high school and he was a senior at that time, which like, oh my gosh, when you're a freshman, if a senior even talks to you? So now they can spend more time together, right? Because they can see each other at school and all of that. And then Terry was finally allowing Charlie to take Aaron out as long as he had her home by 9:30 p.m. So now they can go to friends' houses, they can be alone, all of those things. And that also opened up the door for them to start having sex. I'm sure that Terry would not have liked that.
No.
He wasn't like, "All right, y'all go have sex now." Like, you know, she's 16 years old, but they're kids, of course, that's what they were doing. Charlie is driving one day. He gets pulled over. I'm sorry, he doesn't get pulled over. He just did pull over. I don't know why I threw a police officer into the situation.
Yeah, that's not even it. But hey, Torella, did you realize it's like to pull over and pull over like a sweater?
It works the same way.
But I know.
Yeah. Yeah, so he just pulled over himself.
He pulled himself over, yes.
Yeah, because then what he did is he got down on one knee and he gives Aaron his grandmother's engagement ring, and they used it like as a promise ring. It wasn't like an actual like, I mean, but to a kid that young, I remember I had a friend who had gotten a promise ring from her boyfriend, and I was like, oh, I want one of those. Like, that means getting married.
But also the, like, I don't know. I would have, if it had happened to me in high school, gotten a promise ring, didn't. But if it did, I would have expected like a mood ring or something. Your grandmother's engagement ring? Like,
that's kind of a legit engagement ring.
I know.
Yeah. That's an engagement ring. Yeah. I mean, of course, they're young, so they're calling it a promise ring, but that's certainly an engagement ring. So, of course, Erin's over the moon, right? Like, she's super excited. But she didn't really... It's not like she came home and was like, Mom and Dad, he gave me a promise ring. Like, Penny just noticed her wearing it and was like, hey, girl, what's that? Like, where did this ring come from? And so she told them what had happened. And they were like, you have to give this back. Like, you're not ready for that. Terry talked to Charlie about it. He was like, look, she's only 16 years old. Like, this is not the right time for that. And he felt that if Charlie was showing him so little respect, how was he treating Erin? And especially now that he's not around all the time when they're together. He didn't trust it.
This is giving me such Dan in real life. You are a murderer of love. Like, remember the middle daughter? She was like so in love with her boyfriend. And he was like, you don't know what love is. Like, you're however old, 16, 15, something like that. And she was like, I love him, though. I love him. I know I love him. And anyway, her big lie, I quoted it all the time. But like, you are a murderer of love. And it's like, that's Erin in this situation, I feel like.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Because from this point on, Terry and Penny told Charlie that they were going to have to start limiting their time together. Because at this point, everybody described them as completely inseparable. They were together at all times. He was always at their house. If he wasn't at their house, they were on the phone or they were out together somewhere. Like, it was, you know, he was everywhere that she was. And that feels not healthy. You know, I'm sure as a parent, you're like, this is too much. Like, you need to have that healthy... You still need to see other, like, have friends, do family things, like...
But you don't even know who you are at this stage of life. I'm not saying that it hasn't worked before and it can't work, but you don't know who you are. You don't know what you want out of life or out of a relationship. So you need to play the field. You need to find other people to spend time with and date around and see, like, you know, it's just, yeah.
And this is such an impressionable age. I mean, she's only 16 years old.
And he's older.
He's older. And she's going to, like you said, alluded to, she's going to make herself, the person she's going to develop into is going to be the person that he wants her to be, right? Because this is the only relationship she's ever known. So if there's anything that's going on that is not appropriate, she has nothing to reference or compare that to. Mm-mm. And like, that's the age that I was when I got into a very abusive relationship. But I didn't realize that it was abusive because I didn't have anything really to compare it to. And I just thought, and we've heard this in one of the cases that we covered, we've heard it more than once, but the woman who was in this abusive marriage said, I just thought that's what love was. I just thought that's what marriage was because I just didn't know. I just thought, well, yes, this is how it is. So I need to deal with it. I need to figure it out, you know? It's on me to figure out how to deal with this because that's just what it is, you know? And like, she's so young, that's what she's going to think. And I mean, even him, like if it's the other way around, he's going to, you know, they're just both so young. It's just, it's a lot. Erin doesn't like this rule. She doesn't like limiting her time with Charlie. She started arguing with her parents. She was acting out. She threatened to run away. They started fighting a lot about a lot of stuff, but everything kind of always circled back to Charlie. And one night, Penny found that Erin had snuck her cell phone into her room after curfew and was talking to Charlie. So she took Erin's phone and car keys away and told her that she was grounded. And so this now takes away Charlie's weekly visits because she's grounded. And at this point, people said that Erin seemed like she'd lost her light. They said she was no longer bubbly and bright. She seemed like she was doing everything half-heartedly. those at church who knew the Caffey said that they felt like something was wrong. They said that Aaron kind of appeared distracted and uninterested. Penny also became withdrawn, constantly saying she needed to spend more time with her family. On February 27th, 2008, Penny's sister suggested she take a look at Charlie's MySpace profile. This is the straw that broke the camel's back, because MySpace is the ultimate representation of who you are as a person.
Back then, hell yeah, it was.
Oh my gosh. I still can't believe Facebook hasn't jumped on the changing your page, like changing the appearance of your page, although nobody would care about that anymore. But being able to set a song that plays when you land on your profile and have glitter coming down in the background, shut up.
Right? Heart, something like that. If you, I'm still all in for a top eight. That's all I want is a top eight.
Mm-hmm. I feel like some healthy competition is never a bad thing. You know, if I'm mad at my husband, I can move him down a little bit. Now he's got to work to get back up there.
I also saw somebody said instead of a top eight, it's like the bottom eight. Like you are on you're on thin ice here. Oh. And you better watch yourself.
I like that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's come out with one of our own that's like just negativity all the way around.
Shade, the shade.
Hey, y'all. Did you know that we release an update all about us and what we're up to each week on our Patreon? It's called Tea to the Fourth Power Y, which is some time to talk to you, a nod to Not Another Teen Movie. Mm-hmm. And it's where we just gal pal with you about life, what we're watching, our love for Cracker Barrel Italian dressing. I mean, honestly, the sky's the limit.
You never know what you're going to get, really. Mm-hmm. If you want to catch an episode without being a patron, you are in luck. Just head over to killerqueens.link/TT. TTY, okay, time to talk to you, four T's and a Y, and you'll get to hear a full episode for free. And you can get every single regular release episode ad-free for as little as $3 a month. That's less than half the price of the coffee I get at Starbucks, so.
I know, that's crazy.
I know, what a deal.
Mm-hmm. And for $10 a month, you get all that plus our other two Patreon-exclusive shows, Murder Mixtapes, which is a full bonus case each week. Recent cases are Tara Grinstead, Hannah Cornelius, and New York Body Snatchers, just to name a few.
And you also get our other Patreon-exclusive show, Doc Jams, which is where we cover true crime documentaries episode by episode. We've done Don't Fuck With Cats. We've done Crime Scene on Netflix. They have Cecil Hotel and Times Square Killer. We've done The Jinx. We've done so many more. So be sure to head to killerqueens.link/TTTY to get your free episode and hundreds more episodes to download right now and binge when you become a member of our Patreon community. All right, so they look at his MySpace page. It's not good. There are several comments about sex and alcohol use. It alluded to him being sexually active, him doing not necessarily drugs, but definitely drinking and partying a lot. And they're like, that's not who I want my kid around, right? So they talk to Erin about this when she gets home from school. And they're like, he's just not the right person for you. This is over. You're going to have to completely break things off with him. And to their surprise, she didn't argue with them. And her best friend said that she talked to her about it. And she was like, you know, they're right. Like, this isn't right. I've been wanting to break up with him for a while, but I just didn't know how. And so now she seems almost relieved to use her parents as the reason why she has to break up with him.
Mm-hmm.
And she promised, I'll break up with him. You're right. It's the right thing to do. I will make it happen.
At 4:30 a.m. on Saturday, March 1st, 2008, the Raines County Sheriff's Office received a call from a local named Tommy Gaston. Tommy told the call taker that there had been a shooting at his neighbor's home and that the father had made his way home or made his way to their home and was severely injured. The father was Terry Caffey. The first deputy to arrive on scene could not believe what he saw. As he pulled down the winding road surrounded by trees that led to the Caffeys, the night, of course, at 4:30 a.m., still dark. But he got closer and he saw that the house was completely engulfed in flames, and it looked to have been burning for quite a while.
He immediately radioed dispatch to have them send the fire department, and he quickly made his way down to the Gaston home where the 911 call had come from Tommy. Inside the home, along with Tommy and his wife, was Terry Caffey. He had been shot 5 times, once in the head, twice near his right shoulder, and 2 times in his back. He was covered in blood. And this is, it's a cold early morning in early March.
Mm-hmm.
He only had a t-shirt, pajama bottoms, and one sock on. And there was so much blood that it was really difficult to pinpoint where everything was coming from. He learned that Terry, after being shot, had crawled from his home to the Gastons, and this is about 500 yards. It took him almost an hour. He stumbled through brush. He fell into a creek, but he had made it. The will to survive for this man. And before the ambulance arrived, Terry told the deputy that his family was gone and that Charlie Wilkinson had shot his family. Later, after being loaded into the ambulance, Terry told a detective that Charlie had broken into their home and shot everyone while they slept. He added that they'd recently told Erin that she could no longer see him. It did not take long for the deputies to locate Charlie. They got to a double-wide trailer where a male answered the door. He told police that he didn't know if Charlie was there, but he was like, come on in, you can look around. And they found Charlie inside. He was laying on a mattress. He's wide awake. There was a gun on the floor beside him. And when asked, Charlie denied being involved in the attack, but he did tell the deputy that he had gotten drunk and passed out the night before. Another deputy went back inside the trailer to grab Charlie a shirt and his boots, and he noticed that both had blood spatter on them. Charlie was then taken to the police station while firefighters continued to extinguish the flames at the Caffey house. And they ended up finding 13-year-old Matthew, 8-year-old Tyler, and their mother, 38-year-old Penny.
So Raines County deputies obtained a search warrant for the trailer where Charlie had been found. Chief Deputy Fisher looked around the living room and found a camouflage purse. Tell me you're from rural Texas without telling me you're from rural Texas.
Oh, yeah.
And a driver's license inside the purse belonged to Erin Caffey. So he goes back into the room where they had found Charlie earlier. There were spent shell casings on the floor, a box of ammunition by the bed, and a used condom on the floor. Because all those things go right together, don't they? Do you not have a garbage can in this entire trailer, dude?
Well, if you saw pictures of the room,
it's pretty bad. So there's like this giant pile of like clothes and blankets, like giant, and something moves in it. And he lifts the blanket up and there's Erin underneath this pile of crap. So she is wearing pajamas and sitting in the fetal position with her back to the wall. And at first, I mean, he assumes this is Erin, but she's small and blonde, but he asks her name. She says Erin. And he asked how she'd gotten there. And she looked very confused. She said she didn't know how she'd gotten where she is. She didn't know where she was. He thought that maybe she was under the influence of something when he was talking to her at first. He asked her what happened, and her only reply was fire. And she's speaking in a very like meek, mild, just real quiet voice, and like not getting, she definitely seemed like maybe she'd been drugged or something. Like it seemed like something was going on. So they take her to the hospital in an ambulance. Detectives were quick to interview the remaining Caffey child, and Erin still seemed confused, continuing to say that she was only 14 years old. She told officers that she had woken up in a house full of smoke, that there were two men with swords that were dressed in black. They told her to get on the floor. And then she's like, that's the last thing she remembers. She doesn't know how she got to the trailer, but she did recall drinking something that she'd been offered while she was there. She didn't seem to show much emotion. She ended the conversation by telling the detectives, they're coming after me. And they were shocked that she was even still alive and let alone unharmed after what had happened to her entire family.
So Terry is recovering in a hospital bed at this point, but he would later give a pretty detailed account of what he remembered from the night of the attack. He'd come home that Saturday night around midnight. He had just gotten off a 14-hour work shift. He had a quick dinner, then he goes to bed. Around 3 a.m., the door of the master bedroom slams open. And at first, he thought it was maybe one of the boys who had had a nightmare, but then he realized very quickly that something was wrong. And that's when the gunfire starts. He tried to protect Penny, which caused him to be shot in the arm and the face, and he falls out of bed. He then loses consciousness. When Terry awoke, he could hear lots of noise and two voices. Someone kicked him in the foot, and he cannot feel the entire right side of his body. Then suddenly, he remembered that his kids are still in the house. He heard footsteps on the stairs, and he tries to pull himself up. He then hears his oldest son cry, quote, "Charlie, why are you doing this?" Terry immediately knew that Charlie was there to get revenge. And he hears his son cry out again, "No, Charlie, no." Then more gunshots. Terry falls back on the floor and he goes unconscious again. When he woke up, his bedroom was in flames and he finally pulls himself up. He sees his wife. She was beyond help. She had been nearly decapitated with a samurai type of sword that the other man, so Charlie, and then there's another person there, had brought with him. And Terry knew that he had to get help. He was able to climb through the bedroom window, and then he crawled the 500 yards to his neighbor's home. And this is, I cannot believe that he was able to do this. I mean, it's shot incredible. Five times in the head. I mean, he's in and out of consciousness. He can't feel half of his body, but he makes it. Because he's trying to get help, but he knows that his entire family was very likely already dead.
It reminds me a little bit of the Wichita Massacre. Because remember the one survivor, she saw somebody's lights that had been still on.
Yes.
And he saw the porch light of his neighbor. And that was his, like, if I can just get to that light, if I can just get to that light. Oh, so sad and like incredible, but in such a tragic way. Oh my gosh, like what the human body can do. And he did say too that like at that time, like he knew that his wife was dead. He knew that his family wasn't going to make it, but he also had this feeling in his mind that like, if I can just get there, maybe we can get them help. Maybe we can fix this. And it's just so sad.
I know.
All right. So Charlie is being interviewed and it literally didn't take him very long to break. They told him he'd been identified by a victim who'd survived the attack. And he, of course, had no idea that that was even a possibility. So after that, he told detectives that Erin had called him the day before and was livid that her parents told her that they couldn't see each other. And she told Charlie she wanted them dead. And he was like, or we could just run away together. And then you can come back.
Option yeah. here.
And then we can come back after you turn 18. They can't do anything after you turn 18. And she's like, no, they will come and find us. That will not work. They have to die. So Charlie said that around 1:30 a.m. on Saturday morning, he and his friend Charles Wade went to the Caffey home. Charlie had offered to pay Wade $2,000 if he helped with the murders. $2,000 to kill an entire family.
Now, I understand that when you're 18, $2,000 sounds like
a ton of money.
Oh, sure. Like, well, I'll never have to work again. We got $2,000.
Yeah.
To kill an entire family.
Yeah.
And then spend the rest of your natural born life in prison.
Yeah. I'm sorry if I'm giving it away,
but
you're going to get caught. Like, you just will. Because, like, even if you don't think anybody survived, who had a motive? I mean, come on. So, like, you're going to get connected to this. And the detectives, when they were interviewing Charlie, and he said, yeah, I asked my friend, you know, hey, will you do this with me? They were like, well, what'd he say? And he was like, he just said, okay. They were like, did he ask any questions? Not really. He just said, okay, cool.
I'm so, like, I'm appalled. Like, how? Because I'm telling you right now, I've never been propositioned in this way. Thank the good Lord in heaven. Thank Dolly Parton. Thank it all. If I had ever or am ever going to be propositioned, hey, will you help me murder some people? The answer, of course, is give me a second. I need to make a quick phone call. It has nothing to do with what you're talking about, though. And then another answer after that is fuck no, though. Like,
exactly.
Absolutely not.
Like, what is happening? I just don't understand it. Like, and it's just like no questions asked. Like, okay. And then they were like, oh, also you can get $2,000 because Aaron says her parents have $2,000 in a lockbox in their house. And he's like, psh, done. Fine.
Icing on the cake, right?
Exactly. That's not the only other person involved. So then Wade asks his girlfriend, Bobby Johnson, to be the getaway driver. And she says, okay. He said that they almost turned around when they get to the house and they hear the Caffey family's dog barking loudly. But Aaron called Charlie to tell him that she would keep the dog quiet. Don't worry about it. The group picked up Aaron at the end of her driveway and they drove around for about an hour talking about what they were going to do. And Charlie claimed that he told Aaron several times again, look, we can just run away. But again, she said, no, they've got to be dead. They've got to be dead. She insisted, according to Charlie, that they would need to kill her brothers too. And this was because they picked on her and she didn't want them to be left in foster care either. That wouldn't be fair to them. So they go back to Aaron's house with the plan that Charlie would kill Terry and Penny and that Charles Wade would kill her two brothers. Charlie even told detectives that he had no conscience and killed them because he thought he was in love. And he said that Aaron and Bobby stayed in the car while the boys went inside. Charlie first entered Terry and Penny's room, firing at them until the gun jammed. Wade fixed the gun. Charlie fired a few more shots. They left the room, but then Charlie came back in and cut Penny's throat.
Why? Almost decapitating her.
This was a really big sword. Like,
and it's
scary.
I don't know. I guess I'm not really sure the different types of, if there are different types of samurai swords, but it looks like, I don't know, I've seen it. There's somebody on YouTube, I think, that has this type of sword that's like hung up on a wall. It looks almost like Zelda-esque to me or something. Do you know what
is
I mean?
It like a katana? Is that the right word for it?
I don't know.
I know that, well, you didn't watch Walking Dead, did you?
No, I did not. I mean, Michonne, I had nothing against it. I just never watched it.
Yeah, Michonne in the like later-ish seasons. I think it's still going. I don't know. But like we watched for a time and now we're done with it. But Michonne, the character, she carried two katana swords.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Which Andrew and I have decided is honestly the best way to go in a zombie apocalypse. I mean, you're going to want guns too, but they're loud. They draw the herds in. So if you've got the sword, you're just boom, 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 boom. No noise.
Understandable. Yes, I get that completely.
That's in the most Walking of my Dead, sword knowledge, though, is Walking Dead.
In The Walking Dead, excuse me, side note, are they fast or slow zombies?
Slow. They're not fast.
Okay. Sometimes they're fast, and I thought, you know.
Yeah, and just some things they are, not that. No, they're slow. But, yeah, they, like, he goes back in, and like you said, nearly decapitates her. For whatever reason, I'm not really.
That is such a personal and vengeful, you know what I mean? Like that, he had to have really, really hated her. I feel like to have done that, to go that much overkill and overboard.
Right, exactly. And this is so sad. I mean, this is, we've discussed it a little bit, but just extra trigger warning because this is where the children are attacked. They heard the gunfire and they went and locked themselves in Aaron's room. That almost breaks my heart more than anything else because they felt safe with her.
Mm-hmm.
And it's on her orders that they are killed. This is their older sister. Wade supposedly threatened to leave if Charlie didn't go upstairs to kill the boys. Charlie told the boys to come out of Aaron's room and go to their beds. Matthew tried to fight Charlie, and as he did, Wade from downstairs pointed his gun at Matthew and shot him in the face. Wade then came upstairs and found Tyler hiding in a closet, and he stabbed him to death. As Charlie recounted the murders of Matthew and Tyler, this was the only time he showed any emotion during his confession. After the two believed everyone in the house to be dead, he brought a pre-packed suitcase of Aaron's belongings out to the car. She was ready to go. Charlie and Wade got the lockbox out of Terry and Penny's room and then used their lighters to set fire to... They literally just like kind of walked through the house and like took a lighter and like light that on fire, light that on fire, light that on fire. And they get back in the car and Charlie said that Aaron looked happy. And she said, I'm glad that's over. Wade dropped Charlie and Aaron off at the trailer where the two had sex. Remember, used condom was found on the floor. So they get back. Her entire family has just been brutally murdered. And she's in the mood for sex.
Like celebrating what just happened. And
mm-hmm. And then they fell asleep because that's tough work. Aaron, who was very likely shocked to learn that her father was still alive, was given a toxicology test. She showed no signs of impairment and like no signs of smoke inhalation. And remember, she told the detectives that when she woke up, her house was full of smoke. She didn't know what was going on. These people drag her out of this burning room. There's no smoke on her clothes. There's no smoke in her lungs. She would have smelled like smoke.
Yeah.
And your hair picks that up. Like, big time. If I go to a bonfire, I smell like a country ham for a week, no matter how many times I wash my hair. Like,
absolutely.
She's got no smoke anywhere on her. Like, none of it. And so her story is completely unraveling. I mean, that in and of itself is like, no, you didn't. Just, no, you didn't. So they find Bobby Johnson at the restaurant where she worked, and she initially denied any involvement until she found out that the police had already spoken to Charlie. Wade was also taken into custody. He showed absolutely no remorse during his account of murdering Tyler and Matthew. And he also added that as they'd driven away from the home that night, the house is on fire. Her family has been brutally murdered. I cannot stress that enough.
Well, and she at this point thinks that every one of them, she has no idea that her dad has survived, right. But.
And I don't know how much detail they would have given her in that moment if she had known anything about the sword, but she obviously saw them bring it back with them and like, or leave with it. I don't know. But anyway, Wade's testimony is that as they were pulling away in the car, she said, holy shit, that was awesome.
I am just so confused because I know that there is a statistic that 1 in 10 people is a sociopath. What is the statistic for a psychopath? I know sociopaths don't really have any, is it that they don't have any remorse? They don't, that like being caught in a lie does not bother them.
It doesn't embarrass them,
right? Yeah. But what are the odds that these four individuals in a tiny town in Texas have found each other? None of them care.
Right. Because I do understand that they're young and the, you know, part of your brain that is going to think ahead about things, consequences, you know, executive functioning, all of those things, that's not fully developed until
your prefrontal
25.
Cortex, right? Yes.
They're not fully developed. I understand that. But to be this cold and like you said, four of them. No problem whatsoever with any of this.
It's astounding to me that not one of them really seemed to feel anything outside of what going to happen to me after this.
How many teenagers were involved in Seth Jackson's murder?
Tell me about it. Exactly.
I mean, that's scary. And like, that's something that, you know, there may be people out there who disagree with Penny and Terry's rules or parenting style or things like that. And that's for, you know, that's fine. You know, it's their family, whatever. But it certainly is important that you know who your kids are hanging out with and you know what kind of people they are, because maybe one of these kids on their own, not all of this would have happened, but the four of them came together and said, yep, let's do it.
Absolutely.
Like, that's scary.
Well, and while I was researching this case, and seeing the rules that they had put in place before the MySpace thing happened, I was like, wow, she had it kind of made at 16, being able to...
We couldn't do that shit.
Hang out till 9 or 9:30, stay on the phone till 10 or 11. Like, that was not...
Yeah, we, like, once I started driving, we had to be home before dark.
Mm-hmm.
And that didn't change with daylight savings time. I had to be home... I had to have you home and me home before dark in the summer, which would be 8 or 9 sometimes. But I also had to do that in the winter. So now we're looking at 4 or 4:30 p.m. or whatever. And sometimes just with the school and the buses or whatever, like, we got in trouble a few times for not being home in time. And I'm like, I just couldn't get out of the parking lot. Like, I literally came straight here. Like, you know, you get to stay until 9:30 with your boyfriend.
with your boyfriend. Like, that's not, we didn't have that. Mm-hmm. So I don't, I mean, it's all perspective, whatever. I don't know. But I was just kind of like, man, she really, I don't see where the complaining came from. Like, you kind of had it made, girlfriend.
No. And it seems like she just had this sense of entitlement of just like, well, this is what I want, so therefore I need to get it. I mean, and just the sheer ability that she had, even if you're mad at your parents, to order a hit on your two younger brothers. There's something.
Because they picked on her.
In you.
Oh, yeah.
They're little boys. And they obviously felt like she was such a safe space and that she could have protected them. And little did they know this was her word that this was happening. I mean,
I hope to God, I mean, we haven't heard any of this kind of stuff, but I hope to God that those boys had no idea Aaron was behind this. I just really do. Everyone at the station, the police station, is ratting Aaron out at this point. And she was in the car with her grandparents, who were taking her to see her father in the hospital. And she was escorted by the chief and deputy. And another officer called and informed them that they needed to take Aaron into custody. And they could not believe it.
Yeah, at this point, they still think she's a victim. They think that Charlie and his friends broke into the house, killed her family, and then kidnapped her. That he was just trying to get revenge. They had no idea that she had been part of it.
Not even a little bit. So they pulled into a parking lot. They followed, they were followed by the car with Aaron and her grandparents. And the officer told them that she was arresting Aaron in connection with the murders. Aaron's grandmother is hysterical at this point. And Aaron is telling her, I had nothing to do with it. I promise it was not me. I don't know what they're talking about. I had absolutely nothing to do with it. So because she was a minor, Aaron had to appear before a justice of the peace before being questioned. She declined to speak with officers, but she did agree to a written statement. Her statement was in line with what she told officers when she was initially taken to the hospital, that she had absolutely nothing to do with the attacks. 16-year-old Aaron, 19-year-old Charlie, 20-year-old Wade, and 18-year-old Bobby were all charged with 3 counts of capital murder. Their bond was set at $1.5 million each. When Chief Deputy finally broke the news to Terry that his daughter was heavily involved in the attack, of course, he was absolutely heartbroken. And there is audio of this, and it is hard.
It's so sad.
Hear.
Yeah. Because he says, I don't want a lot of details, but how much was she involved? Like, how deep was her involvement? And the officer just goes, I think, what did he say?
It was great.
Her involvement was great. And Terry, oh my gosh, it's heartbreaking to hear. He just collapses into sobs.
Because I think that you can hear in that moment his heart actually breaking. And he is just, I mean, sobbing. And they're trying to console as much as can be. They're trying to console him, but they tell him that Aaron is in custody. And of course, Terry's like, how could my sweet daughter have been responsible for planning the murders of him, attempted murder of him? Because if she had it her way, he attempted murder is murder with a whoopsie.
Mm-hmm.
And then his wife and his two boys. So as Aaron remained incarcerated, Terry attended the funerals of Penny, Matthew, and Tyler, and he stayed with his sister for quite some time. He didn't have a house to go back to. Unsurprisingly, Terry became significantly depressed. And again, I mean, it's like, on one hand, I mean, I am in awe of the fact that he survived this. And you think, like, in a lot of ways, how lucky. But at the same time, that's the ripple effect that we have talked about time and time again. This is not something that is easily reconcilable.
Mm-mm. And now he's been given a life sentence.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he's been given a life sentence too, of losing his family, of having to reconcile that his daughter planned this, like, of all these things.
Well, and I'm sure it goes from, I can't imagine the roller coaster of emotion he was feeling with at first being like, oh my God, thank God Aaron's fine. I have someone left. And now she's gone because she's now in prison or in jail. And yeah, it's just, oh, it's so sad. And he made the decision that he wanted to end his life. He considered going to the remains of his family's home and shooting himself, but he decided that there had already been too much bloodshed. Terry then decided that he'd take all of the pain pills he'd been given, a bottle of Jim Beam, put a hose in the tailpipe of his truck, and run it through the window until he fell asleep. But he goes back to the property, and he looks at the rubble and ashes that are what's left of his family's home. And he started crying, and he's asking God why God took his family. Terry then, he said he looked down and saw a piece of paper in the rubble. It was burned all the way around it, all the edges. And it was from a book titled Blind Sight, which was about a man who lost his wife and two children in a car accident. The passage on the page that he read said, quote, "I couldn't understand why you would take my family and leave me behind to struggle along without them. I may never totally understand that part of it, but I do know that you are sovereign. You are in control." And Terry realized that he was still alive for a reason, and he decided that he needed to heal. So he ends up buying a used RV. He parked it on the land where his house once stood. Despite everything that had happened to him and everything that he has learned, he actually did make the trip twice a week to visit Aaron in jail.
That's incredible.
And I have definitely heard some people, I mean, you can have whatever opinion you want to about all of this, but the state prosecutor, Lisa Tanner, she had said, she was like, however he needed, whatever he has got to do to get through it,
mm-hmm.
I don't fault him for any of that.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, and he, I would like to think that I could, you know, forgive anybody. You just obviously don't know till you're in a situation, but to see him now, I mean, obviously he would never have wanted any of it to happen, but he is alive and he is vibrant and he is healthy. You know, he's not lugging around that 5,000 pound weight of hate and revenge and anger and, you know, all those things. So, I mean, it's incredible. So now we're going to get to the trials. The state prosecutor, Lisa Tanner, that you mentioned, said that she initially believed Aaron's story and that she was very, very convincing. And I mean, if you hear some of the audio from those interviews, she does sound very convincing. She sounds like she legit has no idea where she is, why she's there, and all those things. But everything in her story was pointing directly to it being a lie. So Bobby told investigators that she'd heard Aaron tell Charlie that night to get rid of her parents, that she was tired of being beaten. Okay. This matches Charlie's and Wade's account of the night. And they've got all of them separated. They didn't really, like, they didn't know the other had been arrested and then have time to get together and, you know, work out a story or whatever. And, you know, we've never heard any evidence of Aaron being physically abused in her home. But how many times have we heard this? I mean, this is beer flavored nipples all over again, right? Like,
mm-hmm.
It seems like kind of a common thing for a female mastermind to do is tell the guy that is in love with her that I'm being, you know, this, that, or the other. And now you've got to save me. And for whatever reason, this guy and his friends are like, yeah, they should die for that. Like, anyway, Lisa Tanner said that the phone records are what truly convinced her, though. Between 11:46 p.m. and 12:48 a.m. on the night of the murders, Aaron called Charlie six times from her house. Between 1:22 a.m. and 1:58, she called him seven more times. And this corroborated Charlie's account that Aaron had called several times to ask them where they were, to tell them to come back, to tell them what she was doing with the dog. Okay, he's quiet. You can come back. Like, all of those things. There were witnesses who recalled hearing Aaron talk about wanting to murder her family. Charlie said that while in school, she'd bring it up once or twice a day. In mid-February, another student allegedly heard Aaron tell Charlie that killing her parents was the only way they could be together. Charlie apparently told several friends that he was going to kill Aaron's parents.
So many people.
So sad. Yeah. It's just so sad. I mean, they literally were just like kind of screaming it from the rooftops. He did tell another friend that he wished they could just run away, or that, okay, well, maybe if Aaron gets pregnant, then they'd have to accept me. You know, they'd let us get married or something like that. Aaron told him she was too young to have a baby and that as long as her parents were alive, they couldn't be together. This is the only option, right? And those who knew the couple said that Aaron had a hold over Charlie and that he would do whatever she asked. One of the most damning pieces of evidence against Aaron was found when her ex-boyfriend came forward. Michael Washburn testified that he dated Aaron before she'd met Charlie, and he said that she told him she was going to hire someone to kill her parents because every time she got a new boyfriend that she really liked, her parents would make her break up with them. Okay, Aaron, I don't know, you know, why we have to say this out loud, but your boyfriend when you're 15 is not the end all be all of your life. Like,
well, and it's such a pattern for her. It's like, it seems like every guy that she came in contact with when she was that age, every one of them, it's like, this is the end of the world if I can't be with them.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And soulmate, that, I mean, it's, love of my life.
Immature. It's very immature. And she is very young. I mean, it's just evidence of the science that our brains are not fully developed then. How many things happen in high school that you think you are never going to recover from? Like, I remember one time somebody told me I had a mustache. So I waxed my upper lip. My skin was so sensitive that I had a red line here for like a week. And it was a bad red line. And I like tried to cover it with makeup, but I put so much makeup on and then the powder and I caked it on and then it got dry. It was just more noticeable. It was a whole thing. And I thought, this is it. Nobody will ever forget this. And I guarantee you, anybody we went to high school with, if I asked them, do you remember that day, that week that I waxed my upper lip at home and it went wrong? People will be like,
no,
I don't remember that. Like, but I literally thought, this is the end of my world. I can't go to school like this. I have to homeschool now. This is it. Like, this is the end of it. Like, yes. It was the most important thing to me. It's just, anyway. Initially, Terry wanted the state prosecutor to pursue the death penalty for both Charlie Wilkinson and Charles Wade. He could not understand how this person who he'd let eat at his table with him and his family could have come in and done this. But as the sentencing hearings approached, Terry ends up writing a letter to the Raines County District Attorney, writing that he wanted Charlie and Wade to be spared the death penalty and for them to have the chance for remorse. And he wrote, killing them is not going to bring his family back and that enough people have died. The two men were offered a plea deal, which they both accepted. Charlie Wilkinson and Charles Wade each pled guilty to 3 counts of capital murder. They were both sentenced to life in prison with no possibility of parole. Bobby Johnson, who'd been named as an accomplice who did not use a weapon, was sentenced to 40 years in prison. Terry urged the prosecutors to give Aaron a lesser sentence, wanting his daughter to have something to live for. I don't know what I would do in this situation because I love my children more than anything. I don't know. I'd probably do the same fucking thing. I mean, I don't know. You know, it's just that's got to be so hard. But as an outsider looking in and knowing that she orchestrated this and that if she'd found somebody else to do it before, she would have done it then. And just the fact that she was willing to kill her brothers.
Yeah.
She never asked for them to be spared.
Mm-mm.
She didn't want to have to deal with them after. And plus, they pissed her off anyway. So they should die. I don't know. I have a hard time with that, but I certainly don't fault him, you know.
Oh, this is his healing.
But it's hard, you know. She accepted a plea deal of 2 life sentences to be served concurrently plus 25 years. So with good behavior, she could get parole at the age of 59. Now, you guys. Aaron still says she has nothing to do with the murders. In the Pierce Morgan thing, she admits to a point, you know, because he says, do you admit or concede or whatever? I don't remember exactly what word he used, but you had the power to call this off and you didn't. And if not for you, this wouldn't have happened, right? And she's like, well, yeah. Yeah. And he said, like, what do you feel sorry for? What do you have remorse for? And she's like, oh, I'm working through that, you know, like I'm still not really sure about that. I'm still working through what I'm actually responsible for. It's something I'm trying to figure out.
And at this point, when they are interviewing her, she has been in jail for almost 8 years at that point. So she has had 7 plus years to have thought about it,
mm-hmm.
to have come to terms with it, mm-hmm. to have been honest with her own damn self.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might think, because how much time do you have? I can give you plenty of reasons why. If you need help, I can help you out with that, Erin.
Yeah.
She can't do it herself. So
no. And like, she told her dad that the reason that she called Charlie so many times that night was trying to stop him. And that once he decided he was going to do this, there was no stopping him. And Pierce Morgan even asks her, well, everybody that was there that night said that you told them that the only way to get past this was that your family had to die. What do you say about that? Why would you say that to them then? And she immediately goes, you know, I've been in here a while and I've talked to a lot of other women here, and all of them have told me, oh yeah, at some point when I was a teenager, I said, I wish my parents were dead. Everybody just says that. And I just didn't know that he would take that and run with it, basically.
You know what this says to me? And I don't know if this is going to, who knows? I mean, she's still got a lot of time left in there. Cause at that point, I think what she was 24.
Yeah.
So she's going to be in, I don't know if earlier, but at least until she's 69. That's a lot of time to hopefully come to terms with it and to come to grips with what she's done. But if she never does, that to me says you should not get out because right. you have no remorse.
Yeah.
You are not taking accountability for anything that you have done because no. she's still playing the victim.
Exactly. Exactly. It's all his fault. And at the time of this interview, Charlie was still saying that he loved Erin.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he still loved her. And Pierce is like, well, do you still love him? And she's like, well, I forget. I forgive him. And he's like, no, but I'm asking, do you still love him? And she's like, well, no, not like that. Like, because she got what she wanted and that's done, right? And even a mental health professional who was appointed to evaluate Erin for her defense said, she's incredibly dangerous. She knew what she was doing. And just the added factor that she had her brothers killed, like that is that's some shit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I just don't understand. She'd been voted most likely to succeed and most fun loving at a church summer camp. But there's that dichotomy because law enforcement says she's incredibly manipulative. She's incredibly dangerous. She is completely devoid of remorse whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And I mean, even like Pierce Morgan asked her, have you and your dad talked about when you do, you know, get out, like what you'll do that day and all that? And she's like, yeah, me and my dad talk about that. The first thing I would do would be pay my respects at the graveyard.
Well, and Pierce is like, what do you think you'll say? And she's like, you know, the first time my dad went there, he didn't have anything. Like, it was just kind of the overwhelming feeling and he really couldn't speak, which she said it'll probably be like that for her. But when hearing that for me, I was like, two different reasons, though, because for you, mm-hmm. you have nothing to say because you don't believe that you're sorry, because you don't believe that you, I don't know, is she buying her own bullshit or is she perpetuating this lie?
Yeah.
So that, you know what I mean? Like, but I don't
also
know.
Like, when you ask her questions like that, her response is always, well, somebody else said blah, 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 blah. And so, and my dad said he couldn't speak the first time. So I'll use that answer. That she's very mimicking social things because, you know, because she doesn't have that feeling. I don't think.
Sociopath.
Yeah.
That's what they do.
Because she's just pulling on, calling on, what have I seen somebody else do in this situation?
Or if she does not do that, what I noticed, and I think you will agree because we just talked about it, but she dances around the question. She won't exactly answer it.
No. There's a guy that I watch his YouTube videos sometimes, Dr. Todd Grande. He's mental health professional. He might be a psychiatrist. I get some of the things confused about what they do.
You sent me.
Yes. I've sent you one of his. He did a video on her and I haven't watched it yet, but I'm very interested to know what he says about...
He did one on Casey Anthony.
Yes. He's done... He did one on the kid that we did who killed Colleen Ritzer. Chisholm... I forget his first name.
Oh, sure, sure, sure. Yes, yes, yes.
Chisholm, yeah. So I think that's when I first discovered him. But I saw that he had a video and I haven't watched it yet, but I'm interested to know. Because just to still sit there and look her dad in the eye, because he still visits her all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And to just be like, yeah, I didn't, my bad. I mean, I didn't, it's not my fault.
Well, she's very much playing it like, I wish I had never met Charlie because, you know.
Yeah, if I'd never met him, this wouldn't have happened. He's the one who took it into his own hands.
He took something that I didn't mean anything by. It was just, you know, a heat of the moment. Oh, I can't stand my parents. And then you took it and ran with it. Actually, no, you organized a hit on your entire family. But
exactly. Yeah, right. Because who knew where the $2,000 in the lockbox would have been?
Who quieted the dog?
Exactly.
Who let them in?
Like, yeah. So Terry Caffey went on to become an ordained minister. He met a woman named Sonia Webb, who he grew close with. They ended up getting married, and Terry became a father again to her two sons. He now preaches about something he's very familiar with, which is forgiveness. He still visits Aaron once a month in a high-security prison in Gatesville, Texas. And again, she still says she's not the one who organized it.
And again, I know that as an outsider looking in, this case makes you feel the feelings because you're like, absolutely not. Like, how could, you know, you have the feelings because it's kind of me not being a parent. I'm like, wow, that's crazy. I can't imagine it, knowing everything that you know. But I don't fault him, and I don't think anybody else should. And I hope, I'm very glad that he has found the forgiveness that he has and been able to live his life moving forward in this way, because there was a point where he didn't feel like he wanted to be around anymore. So
yeah,
I'm very glad for him, but it is, it's shocking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. It's funny how people on the internet think that they have a right to weigh in on the way that he processes this. Like,
well, and Amice,
well, to like all these people who have said things like, you know, you shouldn't forgive her, you know, blah, blah, blah. Like,
oh, absolutely. Yeah. And me saying like, you shouldn't have an opinion, like have an opinion all day long. But like, remember that he's still a person and this is still his family that we're talking about. So I just encourage you, feel the feelings, but take a breath. Maybe don't, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, and hopefully none of us ever have to find out what we would do in that situation. It's just tragic. And yeah, it's just disappointing, but hopefully she's getting some kind of mental health treatment, therapy.
We can only hope.
Yeah. Yep. Well, that's it, you guys.
Yeah, that's it. Thank you guys so very much for hanging out with us and listening to our episode. We love you, and we will hopefully catch you next time.
Bye.
Bye.
We'd love to hear your thoughts on this case. Connect with us on Instagram or Facebook to continue the conversation.
Thanks for listening, and we will meet you back here next week.
Bye!
The theme song for the show is created and composed by Stephen Toby. You can find more of Stephen's work on SoundCloud.
Our logo was created by Sloan Williams of Sophisticated Crayon. You can find more of her work on Etsy. Visit us at killerqueenspodcast.com for merch and other info about the show.